the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. The topic today is gambling, and it's pretty wide open because there are several issues right now on the table. Number one, you have some very recent proposals concerning the prohibition of internet gambling, internet gaming, wagering. Right now, the United States Congress is posed to at least send legislation through the different levels, committees, and all the rest, that would make online gambling a felony. And, you know, I'm against gambling, and that sounds like a pretty good idea to me. And yet you start thinking about some of the ways we treat this so hypocritically in this country. Some of the same people who would vote to make online gambling illegal, maybe even a felony, are taking money from gambling interests in order to give Indian casinos to certain states, in order to adopt state lotteries and do other things. In other words, gambling is becoming a ubiquitous, almost universal part of the American culture. It has gone from being something that was on the margins of society to something that is now mainstream and mainline. And it is coming over in some very unexpected ways. The big national issue is one level of our discussion today, but there's also a very deep personal issue. How many of you have teenage sons or young sons who are really into playing poker? Poker is the big thing on college campuses. It's the big thing among a lot of young people, Texas Hold'em, five-card games, and all the rest. And we're not talking about playing for chips here. Although some of that's going on, we're talking about playing for money. And that's going on at a lot of campuses. It's going on in a lot of different circles, and the conversation is going to go on this program. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. I wrote an article about gambling, published it just several days ago, and I've received a little backlash from some interesting people when I condemn gambling. There's some people who say, look, you're overreacting. It's not a problem for everybody. It's not a problem in every situation. It's not morally wrong in all situations. I'm going to make my argument. We're going to give you the opportunity to make yours. The ground rule is this is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. We'll be talking about how Christians ought to think about the issue of gambling, both at the national level, at your state, and also in your home, having to do with your own family, your own kids, and your own entertainment. Again, the number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. I'm going to roll the dice on this one and say we're going to have some good conversation. First, a review of some issues in the news. On Monday, we discussed the article in the New York Times entitled Men Not Working. And it really was one of those flashpoint articles for me that indicates that we are at a significant moment when in the culture some pathologies arise that point to deeper realities. In other words, the New York Times front page article had to do with men at the prime of their lives, ages, say, 35 to 55, who aren't working and aren't looking for work. Many or even most of them had good jobs, lost them for one reason or another, and they decided they're not going to work. There's other work that is beneath their dignity and all the rest. And so they're living on life savings, mortgaging their homes, living off of that, and letting their wives work. And my response is, from a Christian worldview perspective, that's absolutely backwards. Danger sign, big flashing red light here. Something's wrong in a culture in which some 13% of men in that age bracket don't even think they have to work anymore. That flies in the face not only of the cultural work ethic, but for Christians it flies in the face of a biblical command that a man has a responsibility to work. Men should find a great deal of their dignity in life, in the dignity of their work and their labor. And, you know, one of the things that comes to my mind is the distinction that some of us make between good jobs and bad jobs. And, you know, there really is a luxury here in the 21st century of talking as we do about good jobs and bad jobs. Because, you know, I don't know how you're going to make that distinction, maybe by pay. I think more often it's made in terms of context. There are people who wouldn't want to take out the trash. There are people who wouldn't want to work in the sewers. There are people who wouldn't want to drive buses. They wouldn't want to be mechanics. They wouldn't want to do all kinds of things. Some people wouldn't want to work outside. But somebody's got to till the earth. Somebody's got to plant and gather the crops. Somebody has to make things work, and God bless them for making things work. You know, from a Christian worldview perspective, there really aren't any bad jobs. Not if it's work that needs to be done. Not if it's work that has integrity to it. There is no more integrity in a heart surgeon's work than in a plumber's work. The integrity is in the integrity of heart, doing a good job, applying one's heart and mind to that task, doing it with honor and doing it with skill and doing it with integrity. We have the luxury, we give ourselves the luxury in this culture of thinking of good jobs and bad jobs. And that means that there are a lot of people who think, this job is beneath my dignity. I'm not going to do that. I mentioned on Monday, it reminds me of Luke chapter 16, where Jesus told the story of the unjust steward who says he's too proud to beg and he's too weak to work. And in other words, he's just not going to do that. He's going to become a symbolic analyst. He's going to work with ideas. Well, you know, there are many of us who get to work with ideas, and I'm thankful for that. We get to work with language. We get to work in many different things. We get to teach. We get to write. Those are all good things. But somebody's got to make the paper. Somebody's got to fix the computer. Somebody's got to make the air conditioning run. And God bless them. There's as much dignity in that as in any other calling. You know, this is where the Christian worldview really comes in with a clarification. And during the Reformation in the 16th century, there was a great recovery of the understanding that central to every individual's life is a vocation, a calling. It's not just a job, it is a calling. Now, in the deepest level, that means that it is a calling to fulfill the glory of God in every dimension of life. It is a calling to be Godward. It is also a calling unto Christ that is very important, a universal obligation to confess Christ. But beyond that, for the Christian in particular, the one who's been drawn by the grace of God into a saving knowledge of Christ, one who is in the church, in the body of the redeemed, there is a special responsibility to claim a vocation, knowing that God has given each of us certain talents, responsibilities, and opportunities to do something for His glory. The mom, the mother, mothering her children, is fulfilling a vocation that so beautifully demonstrates the glory of God. The baker, you know the old fable, the candlestick maker, you know the heart surgeon, the industrial technician, the strategic planner, the attorney, you know, it doesn't matter. So long as it's work that has integrity, it's work that is honorable, it's work that makes a contribution, it's work that is needed. That's all a part of God's command to a man in particular to work. And this whole idea there'd be this many men not working is a symptom of a very deep pathology. David Brooks of the New York Times is on to something. And one of the reasons why I brought that back up today is because I had hoped that others in this culture would be expanding the conversation about this New York Times article. And David Brooks on the editorial page of that same paper brings it up today with an article entitled Bye-Bye Bootstraps. He makes a very interesting argument that there has been a values shift in this culture such that in times past, the labor unions were really, really important because rich people were, the professional class were making the worker class work too hard for too many hours and in dangerous situations and without adequate wages and protection and all the rest. There was clearly a need for the labor union movement, no doubt about that. But David Brooks says now the situation's kind of flipped. The middle class, you know, is becoming more and more a leisure class. Not that they're not working hard, but it is actually, in many ways, the executive class that is now completely in a rat race. And maybe executives need a labor union, he's arguing here. He's arguing tongue-in-cheek, of course. But what he's arguing is that something very significant has happened in the culture. Let me read here. He's speaking of the men in the New York Times article who decided they weren't going to work anymore. He says, I try not to judge these gentlemen harshly. What I see is a migration of values. Once upon a time, middle-class men would have defined their dignity by their ability to work hard, provide for their family, and live as self-reliant members of society. But he goes on talking about the leisure class. He says, in other words, the values that used to prevail among the manorial estates, that is the rich, have migrated to parts of mass society, while the grinding work ethic of the immigrant prevails in the stratosphere. It's very interesting. You know, David Brooks is one of these people that gets to be a wordsmith. He gets to work in an air-conditioned office, working for the New York Times, gets to see a lot of interesting people and read a lot of interesting things. And I think it's good that he found this story interesting. And I think this New York Times article is a big, big warning sign to us as a culture. There are others out there, of course, as well. Alan Ehrenhalt, writing at MSNBC.com, that's Newsweek magazine, points out that the baby boomers are now reaping what they had sown. This is another big phenomenon of our time. The baby boomers, the children of the 60s in particular, they called for a moral revolution. They called for a cultural revolution, and they got it. Now, Ehrenhalt calls this a Faustian bargain. You remember Faust, the character in the great novel who traded his soul for what he thought he wanted, and then he didn't want it once he had it. That's exactly where the baby boomers are. Not necessarily all as individuals, of course. We're generalizing here. But as a generation, that's where a lot of baby boomers are. This is how he ends. He says, it's in the nature of human beings to grow somewhat nostalgic as they reach middle age, to look back fondly on the simpler, more innocent days of childhood. But he says, if you were born in 1947 as I was, then the odds are you spent your childhood learning one set of social customs and moral rules, and the prime years of your youth throwing them overboard. It turned out not to be such a good deal, Mr. Ehrenhalt says. The baby boomers got the sexual revolution, the moral revolution, the cultural revolution they demanded, and now they see what it's doing to their own children. We're going to talk about gambling, its impact on America, impact on families, impact on the moral life of the nation. The phone number 877-893-8255. I'm Albert Mohler.
You got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your money. When you're sitting at the table, there'll be time enough for counting. When the dealing's done.
Yeah, you might lose the table as well, though, Kenny. That's Kenny Rogers and his song, The Gambler. It's a big issue today. In fact, gambling, poker in particular, is a much bigger issue today than it was when that song was a big hit on the Billboard charts, because it has become an avocational hobby, indeed maybe even an obsession with a lot of young people. I was talking to some folks the other day, working college students, and they said that young college-age young men, are so heavily involved in poker that's just what they do. They finish their homework, we hope, and hit the poker table. And that's what they want for Christmas, is the poker paraphernalia and all the rest. And it's becoming something of an obsession, to the point that you have support groups, addiction groups, and all the rest. You know, I can remember growing up. I can remember being in college that there were all kinds of card games going on. And yet, I don't know that anyone I even knew played it for money. I mean, it was chips, or if you didn't have that, it was matches. You know, it was whatever you could use to count, and there were no stakes involved. But then gambling at that point in America was largely hidden from view. I was born in 1959, and I mean, so this is, you're talking about the 1960s and 70s, and I was growing up. I didn't see gambling. As a matter of fact, I'm going to tell you that the only gambling I remember seeing as a kid was that sponsored by Catholic churches. It was bingo and you know, raffles and stuff like that. That's the only gambling I even knew about. Well, in intervening years, I've traveled across this country, and boy, this country has really changed. And I'm not just talking about Atlantic City and Reno and Las Vegas. I'm talking about the fact that in some states you can't fill your car with gas without being accosted by the opportunity to buy lottery tickets, or to go in and play some kind of video game, or to use a slot machine somewhere. It's becoming just ubiquitous in the culture, and it has been politically corrupting. All you have to look at is the Jack Abramoff scandal and other things going on in the front pages of our newspapers to know there is real money here, and it's money connected to something that I think is itself corrupting. So, and I mean, it's just bad added to bad. And you look at what has happened to Indian reservations, claiming their status as sovereign nations, you know, becoming basically places where people plant these big casinos. And by the way, there are all kinds of things going on there. There are people claiming to have Native American status, you know, solely so that they can get the kind of casino license that's needed. All kinds of articles about that if you look out there in the media world. But the topic today really has come up because of two things, the confluence of two issues. Number one, the online gambling possibility. The House of Representatives did overwhelmingly pass a law, which, of course, is not yet a law because it hasn't gone through the Senate and signed by the president, that would make online gambling a felony. Now, again, you have to see that there's some level of hypocrisy in that if the same people are encouraging other forms of gambling in other settings. So the question comes, what is it about the Internet that makes it so particularly dangerous? And the answer coming from those who are pushing the legislation is that, you know, gambling through the Internet is just too easy. It'll just lead to a spread of gambling. In other words, the logic behind this is some level of gambling is all right, but too much gambling is injurious to the society. And yet, I said it's a confluence of two issues. The other issue is just all this gambling that's going on among people who never would have considered themselves gamblers. But they are, and especially young people who are drawn into this whole culture of gambling. I want to know what you think about this. The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. From a Christian worldview perspective, is gambling a big issue? I think it is. In the article that I wrote and published at albertmohler.com, I mentioned gambling, and I said that it is inherently corrupting. And I've had people who've called back, written back, and said that's just not true. As a matter of fact, I wrote this sentence. I said, all forms of gambling are predatory and immoral in their very essence. Now, I knew that was a strong statement. When I said predatory, of course I mean it's because in a gambling situation, I don't care what kind of gambling it is, you can't win unless somebody else loses. That is a predatory situation. Sorry. I mean, you can call it anything you want, but if the only way you win is if someone else loses, if you're walking out with 10 bucks, somebody lost 5. I mean, you know, that's the way this works. And I do think that gambling is in itself, in its essence, something that is immoral, which is to say it does not fit the standards of righteousness and justice that I think should be the measures of any activity. Just to tell you the kind of response I got, for instance, the Acton Institute, which is a very fine organization on a lot of issues, it really watches out on a lot of liberty and economic issues. They wrote a blog at their website, which is at acton.org, entitled Gambling Hypocrisy, picking right up on me, and quotes my line, and then the author of this particular article, and I do not see his name right here, it's just on the website, comes back and says, I don't agree, at least insofar as his identification of what makes gambling essentially immoral is not necessarily unique to games of chance, the enticement for people to put their money to risk for the vain sake of financial gain. He compares that to stock markets. Okay, I got an answer to that one, by the way. The answer is the stock market is not inherently predatory, because the stock market is, in its essence, the basis of gaining because of real economic gain, the corporation doing well. In other words, the stock market is a way of pooling resources, and yes, there is some risk at it, but it's not a predatory risk. It is a risk that indeed this company in which you invest is going to do well. And so it's just completely unfair, I think, to say that's equivalent to gambling. Gambling has, you're not investing in something of value. You bring the value, and the sum total of what is waged is all the value there is. But this blogger goes on to say that when I say it's inherently immoral and predatory, he says I'm not nuanced. He says he's talking about the Roman Catholic position, which is different than mine. The Roman Catholic Church in its official catechism says that games of chance or wagers are not in themselves contrary to justice. They may become morally unacceptable when they deprive someone of what is necessary to provide for his needs and those of others. He, comparing that position to mine, says, I find this to be rather more nuanced and accurate as a reflection of the reality of gambling. Well, he's had his say, and I gave him his say on this program. Now you have your say. The phone number, 877-893-8255. Let's go to Kevin calling from Seminole, Florida, listening on WTBN. Go ahead, Kevin.
Hi, Albert. Thanks. Just a quick comment. When my grandfather became mentally disabled, his son, my uncle, was appointed as
executor?
And basically took all of his money and gambled away at one of the Indian casinos. He lost everything.
Everything?
It, except for some of the real estate holdings, all the cash was gone. About $1 million.
Yeah, he must have been something like a steward or trustee appointed over those funds. So, Kevin, your point is that that there is the very real possibility of losing everything. Is that right?
Yes, sir, it is.
And, you know, that's very sad when you hear about someone at the end of life facing that kind of catastrophic loss at the hands of another. But I'll tell you what's really sad to me is when you go to places like Las Vegas and Atlantic City, which aren't the only gambling sites in America anymore. That's part of the problem. But it is where it is basically an entire civilization or culture there based on gambling. And you see what you know are moms and dads putting at risk the money that should be going into buying milk and food for their kids. You know, because of all the pawn shops and everything that's around this, there are people selling their goods, you know, basically pawning their wedding rings and whatever else they can find of value, because they either have to get out of a hole they created by their gambling, or they're so desperate by what I consider to be the vain and unrealistic chance of winning, that they will put their entire family's assets and security at risk. The phone number, 877-893-8255. Poker, slot machines, gambling, Indian casinos, online gambling. It's all on the topic today. How should we as Christians think about this? The phone number, 877-893-8255. Coast to coast, you're listening to the Albert Mohler Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. You know, the game of poker, it has become such a big cultural symbol. You see the stuff almost everywhere. As a matter of fact, you know, even department stores that don't sell gaming paraphernalia. You know, you walk in, they have these beautiful sets of chips and the cards and all the rest, and gaming tables are big. And a lot of people are putting those to good use. And, you know, I want to say something here, just to clarify. I don't think there's anything immoral about a deck of cards. I don't think that a game played with a deck of cards is any more inherently immoral than a game that's played with tiddlywinks or, you know, or gaming questions or, you know, anything else. There's nothing inherently immoral about cards. I don't think there's anything inherently immoral about the game poker. As a matter of fact, I think it could be a thrilling game. I just think when you add money to it and wagering to it, when there's real money on the table rather than just the fun of building up a stack of chips, you've all of a sudden changed it into something that is more predatory. And when you come to play the game with mere chips, you know, you put the chips back in the case and you go home. You know, nobody's any poorer or richer than when he came in. But when you add money, oh, something new's there. And I don't think it has to be a lot of money for that to change the equation. We have Nate on the line calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Nate.
Hi, Dr. Mohler. I just wanted to kind of agree with what you were just saying. I know that me and my buddies play a lot of Texas Hold'em together just for leisure. You know, we use the chips and just have a good time. And I think that there's a bigger underlying problem with just the local lottery nowadays, too, which is a lot of people like to call, you know, a tax on the poor people, because that's everybody, you know, who really shouldn't be playing mostly is just trying to get their big break. So I think, you know, that's another thing that needs to be addressed by Christians nowadays also.
You know, you're onto something big there, Nate. There is no doubt that when you have the state, in this case, literally the state of Kentucky, the Commonwealth of Kentucky, where I am, or almost all the states. I don't have the list in front of me right now, but the majority of states have some kind of lottery or lottery-like game for financial gain. You have the state preying on its own citizens. I mean, that's what's happening. The lottery only works if the state can entice enough citizens to put their money at risk. And the odds of winning a lottery, I mean, everybody knows how astronomical they are. You know, no one should have any sensical expectation that they would ever do anything but lose money in the lottery. Now, if you look at where lottery tickets are sold, they are not primarily sold in the wealthier neighborhoods. They're primarily sold in the least wealthy neighborhoods. And that's where the states, remember, this is a government. This is a government-sponsored entity. That's where they now have to target their sales. Is it the people who are least able to put that kind of money at risk? There's a whole lot there to talk about, Nate. To call, the phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Stefan, calling from WTBN in Seminole, Florida. Go ahead, Stefan.
Yes, Dr. Mohler. Thanks for taking the call. Having a Christian worldview, gambling doesn't provide a proper resources of that which we've got from God, number one. Number two, if you're gambling with the intent of getting a quick, you know, profit, large money, which is what the majority of people are doing with that, then you're specifically not trusting in God. We won't even go into idol worship about gambling, but you're not trusting in God. So, you know, as a Christian, it just doesn't fly in the face of Scripture.
Two good points, Stefan. And by the way, I've been waiting to see if anyone was going to make the link between what I talked about at the top of the hour and the gambling issue. You know, the Bible dignifies work. And the Bible dignifies the connection between work and wages. There's nothing to be ashamed about when you put in a good day's work and you get a good day's wage. There's nothing to be ashamed about there. In fact, it's honorable before God. God's glorified when we use the physical and other abilities he's given us to do something productive and then to get paid for it. That's just. That's righteous. No shame there. But the same culture in which you have all these men who think they don't have to work anymore, large percentage, 13% we're now told of men between the ages of about 30 and 55, is the culture that's starting to celebrate gambling as a major part of life. There's something very frightening there to me. The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. The economics of this, again, you know, may need a little bit of clarification. the gambling setup only works if the money that's being waged is brought in by the bettors. That's true whether it's horse racing, dog racing, whether it's a slot machine or anything else. Eventually, the only money that's there is the money that someone's willing to put up. The house doesn't put up money. The casino's not putting up money at risk. It's enticing you to do that with the hope that you can win at somebody else's expense. Now, you can dress it all up and say, well, it doesn't feel that way when I'm in the casino. It doesn't feel that way when I'm putting the money in a slot machine. Folks, that's the way it works. The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK, coast to coast. This is the Albert Mohler Program. One of the big winners of Hurricane Katrina was the gambling industry. And you may wonder why. Well, just take the city of Biloxi, Mississippi, for example. Hurricane Katrina basically wiped out its gambling industry, but it's coming back in full force. Before Hurricane Katrina, the casinos in Biloxi had to be on barges offshore, but the gaming industry came back and said, look, if we're going to rebuild after the hurricane, you're going to have to loosen up. And so now you're going to have onshore casinos. Reading here from a major newspaper, this is Business News, the Wall Street Journal. We read that it looks like the lifting on the ban of land-based casinos not only helped casinos recover, gave them more room to grow. Mayor A.J. Holloway of Biloxi predicts a building boom that could double the number of casinos in town during the next 2 years. The world's two largest casino operators by revenue, MGM Mirage and Harrah's, are squaring off with new luxury casino complexes, betting Biloxi will reemerge as a more upscale tourist destination. So, you know, you had the capitulation of the state authorities in Mississippi to the gambling industry within weeks of Hurricane Katrina. And so that storm is going to be followed by a storm of gambling. Let's go to Greg, calling from Lakeland, Florida, listening on WTBN. Go ahead, Greg.
Hey, Dr. Mohler. Sometimes playing the lottery would be awfully tempting. This is the one thing that really keeps me from doing it, and that is the Bible tells us that we as Christians are to share the gospel in season, out of season, anywhere, everywhere, and even when we don't feel like it. My big question to Christians who think it's okay to play the lottery is, how in the world am I going to stand in a convenience store where I have other people around me who need the Lord, stand there with a Fantasy Five ticket in my hand and a New Testament, and then continue to converse with them about trusting Christ and being saved? I would feel like I would probably be lost.
You know, very, very interesting email I got today, Greg. I didn't even think about this until you just made that point. I got an email from a man in New York City, and it's the kind of email that encouraged me. This man is secular. He is an unbeliever, and he met one of the students from my seminary, our seminary in New York City, who shared the gospel with him. Boy, that makes you proud. And anyway, he talked about this young man named Nathan, who had shared the gospel with him. And he talked about the fact that he was willing, that this man was writing me, was willing to think about, you know, the Pascal's wager. You know, it's better to believe and find out it wasn't true than not to believe and find out it was true. You know, that's not the gospel. And I'm glad we have a student who understands that. That's not the gospel. You don't present the gospel as in, hey, there's more luck in believing than in not believing. That's not it at all. It's the assured promises of God that underlie the gospel, not some kind of blind faith or reach into the dark. And, you know, when you talk about your Christian witness, yeah, when you're standing there in a lotto line, what are you saying by buying a lottery ticket? You're saying, hey, I want to believe in a world of chance that means that I just might win. And then you want to turn around and say, look, chance really isn't the equation. It's a sovereign God with a providential plan for your life who's called you to believe in Christ. I see the fundamental irony there. It's not just the moral irony of someone who might question, you know, exactly what you believe by buying the ticket. It's even the deep logic of what's involved there. Greg, great point. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Ontario, California, where Denise is on the line. Go ahead, Denise.
Hi there. I wanted to tell the people out there that if they think gambling is not addictive, they're very mistaken. I've watched my son slowly get destroyed. It's wrecked his marriage. It's wrecked his life in general. He's been a bum for a long time. He gets a job for a short while, and he says he's got it all under control, and back he goes. And until he reaches where he'll bend his knee and go and get help, we've tried to help him, but he has to acknowledge that he is an addict to the core.
Well, Denise, let me tell you something. I certainly hope and pray that your son will reach that point where he will get the kind of help he needs. But I got to tell you, I can tell from listening to your voice, he didn't get this from you.
No, he didn't.
Yeah, go ahead. Excuse me, Denise. I was going to say the moral clarity of your voice is very clear there. How do you think, and I'm not asking this just in the case of your son, but how do you think someone gets into this?
He started off as a bar bouncer in a pub, just taking an odd job in a gambling place. And he decided to try the gambling for himself, and he just got hooked fully, and he was off.
That sounds
and
just like a...
Slowly, not even so slowly, it wrecked his marriage.
Mm.
And then he's traveled all over because he couldn't pay alimony. He would travel and leave the country and go back. And it's just wrecked him completely.
Denise, thank you for your call. You know, I'm just so thankful for the moral clarity of your voice. And the story you tell of your own son, it sounds like almost a biblical parable. And I do pray, by God's grace, that this has a happy ending. But, you know, Denise, keep that moral clarity before your son. He desperately needs you to tell the truth, just as you have on this program. And I pray that the Lord will give you the grace and mercy to continue that as well. Let's go to Chris calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, Dr. Mueller, I'm curious as to what you think about poker in the tournaments. That's been such a big fad. I guess I don't see the difference between paying an entry fee and playing a game of skill to see who the best is, with the top ones winning prizes, any different than the PGA Tour, where Tiger Woods pays an entry fee to play a golf tournament, and if he wins, he gets paid.
Yeah, this is where someone will have to correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think I am wrong, but if I am wrong, I need to know I'm wrong. And trust me, someone will tell me very quickly. I don't think that the winnings in a PGA tournament are basically based upon those entry fees. I think the entry fee is kind of an earnest seriousness fee, but you've got corporations pouring vast sums of money into this and an athletic endeavor. And the same way that if you win the Super Bowl, you know, you get a lot of money that way, too. So, you know, someone will have to clarify that for me, although I don't think it's basically a form of betting. But I know there's a lot of betting that goes around those events, Chris. And, you know, when it comes to a tournament, you know, it is in some sense, again, predatory. I guess that would be my first concern. Before you even get to the wagering part, I think it's predatory. If I'm going to put up this kind of money, but in order to win, I've got to beat you, you know, in this coming around. You know, one of the things that I think intellectual integrity demands of us here is that we recognize that we know what a slot machine is and we know what a casino is, but there are other areas of life in which issues like chance and luck, as some people would try to call it, from the Christian worldview, there's no such thing as chance and contingency and luck. But there are people who think in those terms, and economic incentives and all the rest, that they would never call gambling. And my purpose on this program today is not just to point the finger and say, you ought not to do these things. I think that's pretty obvious in most cases. But it is to say we need to review, you know, all of our activities, avocations, and investments, for that matter, to make certain that we're actually not gambling, but we're talking about real economic growth, real return for wages, real constructive justice and righteousness in the society. I'll be back with some final thoughts in just a moment. Welcome back. There are a lot of issues related to gambling in the news. Again, the House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed a bill that will make online gambling illegal if it passes through also the Senate and gets written into law. Jacob Weisberg, writing at Slate.com, suggests that's just hypocrisy. He says online gambling is no different morally than other forms of gambling. This is what he says. But morally and in terms of their social consequences, hard to draw any distinction at all. All kinds of gambling, from bingo to baccarat, are benign entertainment for most people, dangerously addictive to a few, and capable of breeding unwanted side effects for society. You see, I can't go with that. I just don't believe they're benign entertainment for most people. I don't think it's just entertainment. In fact, I have people tell me that they just do it for entertainment and for fun. But, you know, I don't know that many people that consider money to be just a matter of entertainment when it's lost. I don't think that's the way it works, honestly. You know, there is an addictive dimension to this. And, you know, even yesterday on the program, I was talking about not using addiction as an excuse. And we use the word addiction far too loosely. And so I'm not talking about any kind of psychological pathology here. I'm just talking about the pattern of going back to the same thing again and again. You know, why do you go back to the same patterns of bad behavior, of harmful and injurious behavior again and again? Why do you go back? It is because, especially with gambling, once you have lost, you feel like if you can just wager and play a little more, you'll get it back. That really is a part of the insidious deceptiveness of sin, isn't it? And in this sense, gambling just becomes another reminder to us of the fact that we are sinners. If we weren't sinners, then we would not be drawn to these things in which our basest motives become the engines for doing what is unjust, unrighteous, and injurious, even to ourselves. You know, why do you go back? When you know what the odds are, why do you buy that second lottery ticket? You know, you can just look it up in the paper. They have to print what the odds are. Not going to happen, folks. You know, when you lose X number of dollars in the casino, why do you then go and pawn the wedding ring in order to go back? It's because we live as sinners with an enormous capacity of self-delusion. You know, maybe it's important to talk about the issue of gambling just to remind ourselves that whether you gamble or not, and I hope you don't, we still as sinners are always capable of this process of moral rationalization and self-delusion that maybe is easier to see in gambling than in some other areas of life. Let's pray that we will see all those areas of life and respond in a genuinely Christian way. Let's pray for those whose families have been really harmed by this. Let's pray for those who are trapped in these patterns of sin. Let's pray for moral discernment to know not just what to avoid because it's inherently evil, but what we should aspire to because it's morally good and reflects the glory of God. We'll be back tomorrow to talk about moms who are bored with their children. I'm Albert Mohler.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.